Hello, good people. You are listening to Feel Free to Deviate, the podcast about people, their careers, and their relationships with success. My name is Jim Turbert, and I am the host. Episode 45 of Feel Free to Deviate features Yvonne Wetzner, Senior Global Marketing Communication Strategist at Oracle, the gigantic software company. It sounds kind of nerdy, but she's not. I met her long ago when I was a student at Massachusetts College of Art. Her sister and I were friends, and we became friends as well. At that time, she was arty lady about town, organizing film festivals and working for a merchandising company. But shortly after that, she founded one of the greatest video stores of all time, the Video Underground. This episode is brimming with pivots and real business experience, and it's super fun. Perhaps most importantly, it's an example of how one person was able to harness the power of their skills to thrive in a variety of industries. So settle into whatever you're doing, maybe get a beverage, and prepare to be dazzled by my conversation with Yvonne Wetzner. Tell me what you do for a living. When people say, "Oh, hi," what do you like when you're at the school and you're talking to other parents or you're meeting other parents for the first time and everyone's talking about their jobs? People are going to ask you, "What do you do for a living?" And you're going to say,
"I work in marketing." That's usually all I say.
And you leave it at that?
Yes.
I like that.
I do marketing. It's pretty much all I say. I don't really know how to explain what I do, so I just usually leave it at that. I do marketing.
It's interesting that you don't know how to explain what you do, because I was only aware of your job through LinkedIn, and I have no idea what you do.
You know what's hilarious, and this is actually a good story, is that during COVID, when I was staying up, my parents have a house up in New Hampshire, and we went up there for like a month during the summer. Mm-hmm. And I would be on calls all day long. And my mother at one point said to me, "I never understood what you do. And now I listen to you all day long in your meetings, and I have even less of an understanding of what you do." It's like, oh, it's good to know I'm an effective communicator.
Abstraction.
Job well done.
So what do you do?
Yeah. So what do? Exactly. I work for a team at Oracle that basically provides flexible payment options for customers that helps them secure the IT solutions and services they need to keep their businesses running and successful. That's kind of the short answer. But the team that I'm part of is called Oracle Financing, though we never, ever, ever say the F word, financing, because Okay. Nobody likes to talk about financing, right? That's why it's flexible payment options and solutions. Yeah, so don't ever say the F word. That's our jam. My official title is Senior Global Marketing Manager, and it was a new role when I was hired about a year and a half ago. And the responsibilities and the kind of role itself have evolved a bit as I've kind of like felt my way through and got acclimated in the organization and kind of understood how everything works and where, you know, I could kind of lend my skill set. But specifically, my role is to kind of create what they call like go-to-market positioning and messaging for our sales areas, for where our sales teams have identified are the priorities of what deals we need to be in. Mm-hmm. And that sort of means being that link between sales teams and regional marketing teams, and even sometimes like the operations teams. And from all of that kind of like synthesizing of communication, building these end-to-end campaigns that include assets and sales enablement materials and demand generation processes. Any questions on that so far, Jim?
Oh, no, it's all completely clear. I have a
totally clear
crystal
now.
Clear view of what you do on a day-to-day basis. Honestly, I think listeners' eyes probably glazed over at that point, but that's not you do a lot of stuff, marketing, no, not the F word, other stuff. And
no F words.
Particularly sexy, but like from an outsider's point of view
I know, but I love it because I love to like solve problems and I love the freedom I have to kind of like think about new perspectives and like new ways to approach problem solving like every day. And the thing I like best is understanding all that stuff and then figuring out how to best communicate our value proposition to the specific audiences in a simple and straightforward way. Now, having said all that, I'll bring it back to the video store, because in a lot of ways it's really similar. And this is like, how do you go from video store to tech? You know, when I started that store, Before I even opened, I was focused on defining my specific audience.
Yeah.
The JP community, the greater Boston community. What were the pain points? There was not a venue or a channel for them to watch and share independent film in a way that I felt like people wanted. And then how to solve that. Open a video store, all the details of that. And then how to communicate that solution to them most effectively and how, on what channel, right? Like, this was before social media. So there was no Facebook or Instagram posts, but it was like, how do I then, once I have this amazing solution, how do I figure out how to tell that audience that I've defined what's happening, what we're doing, and why it would be awesome for them to come shop.
Right.
So I feel like, if you break it down like that, it is in my brain, at least in my crazy brain, similar, right? Because
it's totally similar. It's software, just analog. Right?
Exactly. So like for me, I'm like defining our audience, like which, sales teams at Oracle are we looking to influence? And then what are their pain points or what are their customers' pain points? Like maybe it's the economy, maybe it's a specific industry pain point, maybe it's a competitive pain point. And then where do we add value, my team, in helping them close that deal? And then once I have all that information, how do I tell them that in a convincing way that makes them want to pick up the phone and call us.
I didn't know that you were working in IT or anything like that until I saw that you were working for Oracle. And then I was just like, how did that happen? Because my whole understanding of you is whether you're an employee or an entrepreneur, you're always kind of art adjacent or something. And Oracle is not really art. I mean, I'm sure that someone could make a case for them being art adjacent, but I just don't see it.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I could make that case that Oracle is art adjacent. It's true. For a long time, I worked in art adjacent. Like when I had the video store, that was 10 years of my life and there was time before that when I was running film series and film festivals around the Boston area for a good 7 years previous. I guess I can back up and tell the story. I sometimes tell the story, my career story, backwards, and sometimes I tell it forwards. And I got a lot of experience telling my career story when I was interviewing for jobs that have now become my current role at Oracle.
Right.
So it's really good at telling it. Before I had the video store, I don't know if you know this, but I was a teacher and a family case manager.
I went
to school and studied sociology and elementary education. And in my early 20s, worked in education as a preschool and kindergarten teacher, and then went into family case management and was a case manager for a family shelter in Waltham, Massachusetts, and advocated for my clients to get employment and housing opportunities.
Nice.
Just kind of help everybody organize their lives, which is kind of ridiculous when you're 23 trying to tell people how to organize their lives, but that wasn't a very long career. And then my career became a series of happy accidents, I guess. A friend of mine in college, I think she wasn't even a friend of mine. It was a friend of a friend in college who happened to be living in Boston, had been working for this startup in Fort Point. And she had the opportunity to go abroad for a year with her boyfriend at the time, who's job was having, hosting him, I think, in Belgium or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so she needed she was looking for a 1 year temp to fill her role. Her boss was like, you can go, but you need to find someone to take your place. So through a friend of a friend, I was connected with her. We met, seemed cool. Her job seemed all right. And I was like, all right, I'll try this. And it was working for a startup in the, I guess, late 90s in Boston. It was a promotional merchandising company.
Right. That's the one that I remember.
Right. Yes. That focused on the music industry and entertainment industry.
It was hip hop artists and indie bands and stuff.
Exactly. And we made t-shirts and glitter sunscreen and tattoos and all these ridiculous. Right. We thought we were super cool. We did all the merch for Newbery Comics back in the day.
Uh-huh.
It was a cool job. And so, but what was really cool about that job was it gave me the opportunity to explore different areas. So I started taking a lot of graphic design classes and moving more into the design front of that and having the opportunity to do that. And because it was a small startup, I think we started with five of us, including my boss. And then it grew to probably around 15 or 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really a great opportunity to kind of like play around and experiment and try new things and be curious, and also to see how a business worked and how a business was run and the, you know, considerations you had to have if you were going to manage a business.
Right.
So when that company closed down around 2001, I took the opportunity and the unemployment benefits I was getting and said, okay, I've been running this film series for like the last 6 years, and I see a market opportunity in Boston to build a video store that focuses on its go to market is really focused on independent film and not a blockbuster model, which was all there was at the time.
Yeah.
And went for it. And I used all the experience I had from my previous employment at the merch company to do that. And it was cool. Like my old boss, who's now like a serial billionaire entrepreneur, was very helpful and gave me a lot of advice, and I think probably like reviewed my business plan. And
that's nice.
But that's how I had the video store.
Oh, I remember you mentioned before the house in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. In 2001, when it was 2000, 2001? I don't remember. It must have been 2000. I was at that house shortly after I came back the first time I went to the Netherlands. I was on exchange, and then I came back, and it might have even been the first night I was back. Your sister and Mandy picked me up at the airport, and we went to a rock show in Dartmouth, New Hampshire, and afterward, like with a bunch of people. And after the show, we all just went to your New Hampshire house, your family's New Hampshire house. Mm. And there was like a room full of video cassettes.
Oh, right. In the basement, and I've driven my kids past that store so before I even had the store, I joined this thing called the VSDA, which was like the Video Software Dealers Association. Uh-huh. It was basically like a professional group for video store owners. I don't even know how one finds this stuff because there was barely internet at the time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, Google just came out.
It was seriously like, no, it was like Alta Vista. Like it wasn't even, probably Google was just coming out. So I started going to these like conferences for video store owners before I had the video store to like network and ask people questions and learn about how video stores work and what you do and like how it works operationally and what people's strategies were. And first of all, everyone thought it was insane. They're like, who is this girl?
Well, that's what I thought when I saw the room full of video cassettes. I was just like, what the hell?
Right.
What is she doing?
One of those, I like met somebody that had a gas station video store in White River Junction, Vermont. Uh-huh. It was like a small video store that was like at like a gas station rest stop in White River Junction, Vermont. And she was going out of business, and she was like, come up, I'll give you like first dibs, mm-hmm. and you can buy all the videos you want from me to start your inventory. And I was like, okay. And you know, for like $1 each or whatever. I'm like, all right, great. So I went up one, I drove up by myself, and I spent like the whole day just pulling out the inventory that I wanted from her inventory and these huge piles. And then I had to, my friend Josh owned this moving company in JP, and I hired him and his moving truck, and we went back to Vermont and piled all the videotapes in his moving truck and then moved them to New Hampshire, where they sat in storage for like probably a year until I got my actual store space, mm-hmm. and had a place to put them.
Right.
And that was, and a lot of those videotapes were, you know, stayed in my store the whole time I owned it. It was crazy. I mean, we sold a bunch of them as video became less of a thing, but yeah, that was the starting inventory of my store.
Yeah, it's awesome. But I remember thinking specifically, like, this is crazy. What is she doing? And then, like, the store opened and it was awesome.
Yeah. Like, why, why does she have a bunch of videotapes in her store? This is weird.
So I guess it worked out. I guess you knew something that I didn't.
Yeah. But I mean, going back, like, everybody at that VSDA, because we used to have, like, annual meetings or buy-in, I don't know. People all thought it was crazy because, first of all, it was almost all men, middle-aged men,
right,
that ran
right.
these video stores, and here I was, a woman, and I was young. And then I was coming in and saying that I wanted to build a business off of not new releases, basically, like everything but new releases. And they thought I was crazy because all of these people were trying to keep up with Blockbuster, and they couldn't keep up with Blockbuster, so they were opening up like tanning salons in the back of their store or like some other supplementary business.
That's one way to
To keep up. It was a very weird trend, but it was definitely a trend. Tanning salons and video stores.
To just...
And here I was saying, like, no, I don't want to do anything like Blockbuster. I want to build the opposite of that. And they were like, yeah, 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 that's cute.
Good luck with that.
Right. And then, like, I became the last one standing.
I know.
Which is crazy. I mean, the other thing that I actually found really interesting, especially looking back, besides just wanting to build a business model off of independent film, was this idea. It's called commingling of inventory. So we were talking about 2000 videotapes I took from this woman's store in Vermont. But then, you know, as we were, that was kind of like the beginning, that was the foundation for the inventory. And then I went through all the, you know, movie houses, all the catalogs, and kind of like cherry picked all of the, you know, important films that I wanted to represent in the store. Mm-hmm. And that was like another, you know, 1,000 movies. But then we needed to have DVDs also, right?
Yeah.
Because we knew that, I think I opened in 2002, like in JP, the neighborhood the store was in, Jamaica Plain, was a slower to adopt new technology neighborhood than some communities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Netflix like hadn't really impacted at all, which was like, you know, mailing the DVDs in the red envelope. Right. A lot, like most of our customers and most of the population didn't have DVD players yet, but I knew that I couldn't invest too much money in videotapes because at some point those were going to become obsolete.
Yeah.
So I filled in the inventory with DVDs, but because I had such a thin inventory to start with, it didn't make sense for me to have a separate DVD section from the VHS, which is what most stores were doing at the time. They had like a VHS side of the store and a DVD side of the store. Mm-hmm. But because I was kind of layering both inventories on top of each other to come up with like one full inventory, I couldn't do that. So I just kind of like had to put the DVDs and the videos together. And that was called commingling. And that was very, very, very unusual.
Oh.
But it was the way that we pushed people and encouraged people to buy a DVD player, right? Because you're looking in the inventory and you own, you know, your ABCD or whatever you're looking for, and you only see it in DVD.
Right.
You have to go buy a DVD player. So that's my exciting inventory story.
That's pretty, I don't, it's the interesting thing about, I mean, starting the business is interesting, and the tumultuous time of the demise of the VHS tape and the video store industry in general is interesting. But the fact that there's a name for the commingling videotapes and DVDs together, it just goes to show that there's a lot more that goes into pretty much everything than you really ever think about. Anyone who walked into the store, I'm sure that nobody who walked into the store except for maybe another store owner thought, oh, she's commingling.
Well, that's how I knew that it was totally weird, right? Because other store owners would be like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have enough inventory. I'm just putting everything together. Like, it would be weird if I had like the tiniest DVD shelf, right? Like,
we have four DVDs.
Right. Like, I'm just putting everything together. But that's how I knew that it was weird. And so that was another reason why they thought I was crazy.
Okay.
Because they're like, you just don't do that. But through that professional network, I did meet several really amazing, inspirational video store owners and film aficionados all over the country, particularly two in the New England area.
Yeah.
who were my complete mentors and amazing. And then
that's cool.
Just really awesome to connect with people all over the country that were doing similar things and share ideas and share what was working and what wasn't. And,
right.
You know, again, this was before social media. Facebook didn't come out for like years. Mm-hmm. I think at this point, or at least I wasn't aware of it. So this was, you know, very organic communication of like calling people or seeing them in person. No, and I remember when we first started a Facebook page, I actually was on a panel at one of these conferences in Las Vegas trying to explain social media marketing to a bunch of like old white guys who own video stores and tanning salons.
What?
Yeah. I remember, I don't know what I said, but I remember sitting up there and trying to explain social media marketing to them. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that was well received. I'm sure they all had good feedback for you.
I think by the time that happened, they were all like, oh shit, like you were onto something.
We should have listened to the young person.
Right? Like you're the only one that's growing. I think at that point, like I had already like closed down the first store and moved into a space three times as big.
Right.
Like, my you know, revenue was growing every year. Uh-huh. These guys were all going out of business. I think by that point, they were listening to me.
Right. They're like, this is the only video store. People were coming from outside of JP to go there. It was like a destination.
Oh, completely.
It was awesome. Yeah.
And what's hilarious is actually one of my coworkers at Oracle, our art director, he's like my age. He used to come in my store.
Nice.
Like when I was interviewing, he's like, oh, I know Yvonne.
Yeah.
And what's also really cool, actually, and like one of the reasons, so I, you know, before I started working at Oracle, I thought like, oh, it's like a huge global software company. It's going to be super conservative and like stuffy. And
yeah, that's kind of what I think too.
Right. It's totally like, it's not. I think the culture in general of Oracle has changed a lot. Everyone I meet is like, so smart and so engaging and like supportive and funny and wonderful and creative.
Oh, nice.
It's a very, very like curious place where people just, you know, ask a lot of questions and get to, I don't know, do cool stuff. But one of the things about my team that I love is like I said, when I was interviewing for jobs and I interviewed for a long time when I was ready to make a change, and I'll go back to my weird career path. But but most places it was like a challenge to explain how did I go from like owning a video store to working in wine and spirits,
right,
to working in technology.
Right.
And I was like, I had to really explain like how they were all connected and like how the skills, you know, what skills I gained and why I was qualified for mm-hmm. this role that I was applying for. When I met my boss, my now boss, like, and his boss, like all they wanted to talk, they were like, let's start here. Like talk about like how you used to have a video store.
Yeah.
And like how, like they got it. They were like, you are so qualified to do marketing because you did it all. I'm like, exactly. You know, like they're like, if you ran a business for 10 years, you like, that's a wonderful benefit for us to have as, you know, for you to be part of our team.
More, you successfully ran a business during the decline of the industry.
Exactly. and they were like the first ones that like, I didn't have to defend it, that they were kind of like, no, this is why we want to talk to
yeah.
you, basically. And I was like, oh, okay.
Awesome.
They're like, this
it's
is
nice
why
to be recognized.
Exactly. Like, not like I'm trying, because I felt like with so many jobs, I was always trying to like explain myself. And,
yeah.
And this team, they were like, no, this is why we want to talk to you, because we think that this is really valuable. And that was nice to hear.
That is really great.
Yeah. So the video store was great. It was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot, blah, blah, blah. And when I had my first child was when it's, you know, Ace was born in 2009, and 2008 was the big recession. So we had been growing. And then the recession happened. And then streaming started to really catch up with us quickly. So like people that were coming in, you know, like three times a week to rent were only coming in once a week to rent.
Yeah.
And it was sustainable, but it wasn't scaling at the same growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a child, and I kind of had to think about like what's next and what's my 10-year plan and my 20-year plan, and decided I would rather go out like, you know, on a good note
sure.
than like run it into the ground. And so I was actually going to just close, and then one of my employees and some of his friends wanted to buy it from me. And to be honest, I sold it like pretty dirt cheap just to like, you know, make a clean break. And
yep.
It was way easier than liquidating all of my inventory.
Well, that's good for them too. I mean, they realized what was going on with the industry, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then they actually sold it to somebody else.
Really?
This guy, Kevin, and it is still around. He has moved it to a different neighborhood in JP.
Oh.
To Eggleston Square. It is still around. It is the last video store in Boston.
No way.
Crazy.
That yep. is crazy.
It's crazy. And I actually reached out to him in the last year, and I was like, I don't know if you know me. Like, I started this store and just wanted to let you know it's 20 years old, which is bananas to me.
It really is.
And actually, Ace, my child, went to go visit it with a photo class this summer.
Nice.
And so I've never even been to his store. And I guess it's like, you know, a cafe and bakery and video store, and they have a screening room. It's multiple businesses happening there. But yeah, so I think he's adopted adapted rather to the changes. Last one standing for real.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. 20 years. I'm like, how is there still a video store? I don't understand.
I don't understand it either. There was one here for a while, but yeah, it's gone.
I'm not that good a person. I'm too lazy at this point. Like, maybe if it was like literally on my block, but you can do so much with your remote control.
You really can. It's a crazy world we live in.
Yeah. So when I sold the store, I had always been really interested in working in restaurants, and I really wanted to like maybe go to culinary school or something like that. But I had this little kid and was like, this, you know, working in restaurants is probably not a great idea with my life as it was. So I thought, hey, I'm going to go take some wine and spirits classes and see if I can get into the wine and spirits industry and like kind of work restaurant adjacent that way. So I did a couple certifications. I ended up getting an advanced certification in wine and spirits. And actually in that class was connected with somebody whose family owned one of the major distributors in Massachusetts or in the New England area. So ended up working in wine and spirits for about 4 years.
Right. I remember that thinking, well, how did this happen?
Yeah, that's how that happened. That happened is me working my ass off to do these certifications, which were really intense. Like I couldn't do them now. And the thing that's crazy about wine particularly is it's like just such a constant learning path and you can just always learn so much more. But like the advanced one was hard. Like I definitely, you know, part of the exam was written and part of it was blind tastings, and you had to do several blind tastings and you had to nail them. And just picture like somebody pouring you a glass of white or red wine, and you have to not only say like what varietals they are, but what region it's from, what country it's from, like do tasting notes and like nail it. And I can't believe I was able to do that, but I did it, which is insane to me because I couldn't do that now.
It is. I think it's insane too, but yeah.
And really nerve-wracking. Oh my gosh. I was so scared for that exam, but it was cool. And so I ended up working for a company called MS Walker and kind of fell into more brand development and product marketing there. So it was a really interesting opportunity to build wine and spirit brands kind of from the composition up, I guess, production to market. And it was really cool. Then I had a second kid and wanted to, what's the word? I wanted to have a job that allowed me a little bit more work-life flexibility.
Okay.
That's a thing.
That is a thing. It's very popular.
Yeah, that is a thing. Yes, exactly. So again, funny coincidence, like kind of back to like the promo merch days. Actually, it's really connected. So my boss from 360 Merch, should I say his name?
If you don't think he'd mind, it's fine.
I don't think he'd mind.
All right, cool.
Dave Balter. Dave Balter went on to basically like create influencer marketing.
Well, someone had to do it.
After the merch company closed and I went to open a little video store, should have gone to work with him, like some of my other coworkers, at this company called Buzz Agent, which was basically the first word of mouth marketing agency, which became influencer marketing, which he then sold to Dunn Humvee for some insane amount of money.
Good for him.
And then, yeah, exactly. So, and then went on to found several other very exciting companies. And right now he's working in cryptocurrency.
Mixed for him, I guess.
I don't know.
Depending on how much of his money's in that. But
I don't understand. So his ex-wife was working for this company called Aspera, this software company, this German software company. And I think on Facebook or something, Beth had written something like, is anybody interested in this job? Like my job, because I'm leaving. And my job is, you know, working in marketing and doing social media marketing and producing campaigns. And I was kind of like, oh, and writing. I think writing was mentioned. And I kind of said at the beginning, I think I am a really strong writer. I've always been a strong writer. I've really liked writing. And to have a job where writing is a big piece of my work was pretty exciting.
Nice.
So I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. But it's software?
Yeah.
It's a German software company?
How do you write about German software?
Right. Like, I don't know anything about that. I went for the interview and met my friend Nicole, who was my boss, and my other friend Nadine, and my other friend Debbie on speakerphone because she was out in the Bay Area, and went into this interview being like, oh, I'm not really interested, but whatever, you know, Beth is awesome and I'll just come check this out. And like left being like, oh, these ladies are all kick ass and amazing. Like this could be fun.
Yeah.
You know, like went through the interview process and had to do like sample writing and all the things. And then I got hired. And I remember saying to Nicole when she offered me the job, I was like, I guess. I was like, but I don't really see how this is going to propel me in my career path. Like, I don't really know how working in marketing for Aspera is going to help. And she's like, well, it is the tech industry.
I was like, heard of it.
Yeah. She's like, it is high tech. I'm like, I guess. And I was like, all right, I'll try it. Like, whatever. And she's like, AMTS, you get to go to Germany with us in 2 weeks for like our annual kickoff.
Holla.
And I'm like, great. She's like, do you have a passport? And I'm like, yes. Okay, I'll try this. And the other piece was that I got to work from home a couple days a week. And that's the part that was really exciting for me because, like I said, I was really looking for something that allowed me to, as a full-time working mom, be a little bit more present with my kids and just feel less like I was racing around on a minute by minute basis, trying to like grab people from after school and camps. And, you know, just
that's big.
My older child was like constantly in childcare when they were little. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I started working for this German software company and I ended up being there for 6.5 years. And it was really cool. I got the opportunity to work with a global team. So I had, you know, coworkers all over Europe, all over the US. I got to develop a global social media strategy in 3 languages for our team and basically like roll that out to the company and then later roll out an employee engagement, an advocacy program for the company, which is it's like influencer marketing, like teaching people how to network and social sell on LinkedIn. I got to create a very successful blog in 3 languages.
Well,
and got pretty involved in SEO, and that became like one of our driving traffic sources for the website. And then the other piece was I got to learn all about demand generation and how to focus digital campaigns on lead generation for our different sales teams. So it was really cool. And I got to be mentored by my friend Debbie, who is an amazing technical writer and really taught me about how to approach these like very highly technical content subjects in a way that was like using simple words and simple language and making things approachable and engaging and understandable for your audiences, and really like just taught me the foundations of product marketing. It was awesome. And I learned so much. And I never thought that I would work in technology.
Right.
But it was really fun. And it was really great to have a job where I got to write so much and work with people all over the world, particularly my kick-ass team of ladies was amazing and really inspirational and supportive. And I think we all learned from each other so much and just learned about how to be a freaking solid team of marketing leaders. It was great. Then that company was owned by a parent company, and the parent company rolled up all its subsidiaries like into one giant company. The culture changed. The leadership became pretty inept. The workplace became really, really toxic from like the leadership level. And so that's when I started looking for work, maybe at the beginning of the pandemic, I think in like 2020. Yeah. And it was a long road to get to Oracle. Like, it was really humbling and hard. I don't think I've ever faced so much rejection in my entire adult life of either like not making it very far in an interview process or making it to like the final 3 and then like continuously like getting rejected at the final 3.
Yeah.
That happened several times. And I don't know when the last time you've applied for jobs are. And I don't know what, if it's different in the States, but now like in, like I had to like create like research projects and presentations and present to like executive boards, like all, like it was like month long processes and put so much time and effort and work into things. I'm like, it was crazy. And I think definitely I did at least 4 different like huge projects for these applications.
And that is presentations. Insane.
It's insane. My parents were mad. They were like, they're getting free work.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that happens here. I've actually been out of work for a while. So I've applied for a lot of things, but clearly I'm not applying for the same jobs that you are.
But you know, the rejection.
Yeah. It's the worst, especially when you go in thinking I'm a no-brainer. Of course they're going to hire me. And then you're like, oh no. And then the next one doesn't. And then the next one doesn't. You're just like, what's going on? This is crazy.
I really think like so much of it. And like I was interviewing for almost a year, maybe a year. That really when it clicked was like when I kind of like pivoted how I presented myself and like played the game a little bit differently. And I think that made a big difference. And I was lucky to have like in all that rejection, a couple really smart, young HR people, like, you know, the people that were doing the hiring, the talent recruiters, like for these companies. And a couple of them, though young, like gave me some really hard to hear, but like good advice
yeah.
that helped me improve how I interviewed, how I presented myself, how I talked about myself. And like that feedback, though hard to hear, I think was really, really critical in me figuring out kind of like how to sell it myself.
What, just give me one thing. Give me one thing.
I mean, one was like, ironically, like about being like a clear communicator verbally, yeah. which again, I started out by saying like, I'm not, like I'm much better at writing things, but like getting to the point really fast, and which is all stuff I do in my writing.
Yeah.
Basically, like when I would interview, I would have one monitor where I had like all, like basically like a script written out for myself that I refined and refined and refined. So when someone would say like, tell me about yourself, I would be able to like, boom, 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 like just hit all the high points. Right.
Yep.
And had interviewed enough to anticipate like the type of questions they would ask me, like, tell me about your go-to-market approach, or like, tell me about a time when blah, blah, blah happened or whatever. And I had kind of stories. And I think that was another thing, is having stories.
Right.
As your answers is really good.
Right.
It's storytelling. You're storytelling about yourself.
Having it all cached up.
And then the more that you can prepare and have those stories ready to go and know how to fit like what story into what question to make the answer engaging.
Yep.
I don't know. It's hard. One thing that the pandemic taught me is that I am such an introvert, and it's so hard for me to like push myself to be outgoing. And I think, you know, when I had my own business, I just pushed myself all the time to just pretend to be a different person than I am.
It's like, exhausting.
And it's exhausting. And interviewing was exhausting.
Yeah.
You just have to be like psyched all the time and like, you know, engaging and
indeed.
Funny. And yeah. But yeah, interviewing sucks.
It's definitely the worst. But it's better than getting a rejection letter immediately.
Or just not getting anything.
Or not getting anything. I guess that's the worst.
Definitely happens. But it's funny. So like I started interviewing for Oracle, and I applied like on, I think I had just gotten like to like the end of another situation and been rejected. And I was super just down. I just like fired off a bunch of resumes. And one of them was for this job at Oracle. That was like in August. And I think I maybe interviewed with my now boss at the end of August, beginning of September. I wasn't hired till November. So it was like a 4-month process. And in that time, I thought I was getting another job, and I really wasn't even that interested. So maybe my biggest advice is that I found looking for a job a lot like dating. And my friend Debbie, who was like my mentor in product marketing, is a pro at dating. She's so good at it.
Okay.
And I was always horrible at dating, because I was always just like, be too honest and like be too needy and be too desperate. But Debbie like knows how to play the game.
Okay.
And that's what I found that interviewing was like. It was like, if you were too interested, they weren't interested. But if you were kind of like, take it or leave it, but I'm pretty awesome, like they were interested.
Well, that would explain why my job searches go so bad, because I got married when I was 25.
Exactly.
And
exactly. You just need to get yourself back out there on like Hinge or something.
Anyway, I'm not excited about it, but I'm trying to pick up a couple freelance jobs here and there just because. But it's going slowly. But you got your thing, and that's good.
Yeah. But what was funny is right before I got hired, when they were still like one interview, another interview, I'm like, do I have to do a project? And he's like, should you do a project? I was like, no, I don't want to do any more projects. I'm good. So I actually, ironically, did not have to do any projects for the role that I ended up getting.
Excellent. Project-free employment.
Exactly. And just like dating, it all works out, because I'm real grateful that I didn't get any of those other jobs that I thought I wanted and I thought were the ones for me, because really I'm super stoked to be where I am. And I'm hoping that was the last time I have to interview ever in my life. And this is going to be something that has longevity and growth opportunities. And
it sounds like it would be. It's a freaking ginormous company, and they're not going anywhere. They're like the first database company, right?
Yes.
Like,
that's
kind of the first, right?
Yeah. They're the first database company, and they are, our cloud game was kind of like last to market, but it is kicking butt.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what I work on is OCI, the Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. It's really, I don't know. It's weird. It's weird that I work in tech. I also really enjoy writing about things that I don't understand. I find that like a hilarious.
It's a challenge.
Well, the company I worked for, the German company, the software we created was software asset management, which you're like, what the hell is that? Exactly. It is software that we sell to companies to help them manage all the software they own. It's like a friggin' racket.
Yeah, for real.
Writing about like how that software license management software works was really complicated. And I still, to this day, don't really understand how it worked, but I could write about it.
Right. You knew the keywords.
I was like, I actually don't want you to tell me how it actually works. I much more enjoy successfully writing about this stuff. Like I said, I started a blog and wrote all these articles about, different facets of software license management and different software vendors. And
I was just thinking because you're a movie person, you should have with your coworkers. I don't know if you ever saw this movie, but it's a documentary about Silicon Valley in the 80s or the 70s and 80s called Triumph of the Nerds. Have you ever seen it?
No, but I'm going to write it down.
Oh my God. You got to see it. And you have to watch it with people from Oracle because one of the highlights of this film, there are lots of great things in it, but one of the highlights of this film is Larry Ellison, founder of Oracle.
Oh, I know who he is.
In a hot tub. In the Rockies or something, in some mountains, just talking about Silicon Valley. It is awesome. It's such a good movie.
I don't know this, but I'm going to watch it. And you're right. I think a lot of my team would love it. Oh, yeah. Look it. There's Larry.
Triumph of the Nerds. It's a really, really great documentary. Also, they show early.
I bet my boss has seen it.
I'm sure.
He's super into music and film, and he also came. Him and his boss came from Sun Microsystems, which Oracle acquired back a while ago, and they're all been in tech forever.
Yeah, old school. Very dudes.
Cool. Oh, it's a PBS.
Dude, it is so good.
It was a PBS produced thing. All right, cool.
They show all these crazy old Microsoft ads and stuff, and or anti-Microsoft ads from Apple or whatever.
It's I'm totally gonna watch.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Even tonight. Ooh, thank you.
You can combine the wine and spirits with the films and with the Oracle and get it all together and have a movie night with your employer and your colleagues.
That sounds amazing.
I think it would be good. I mean, I would love to go.
I'll let you know. We'll zoom you in.
All right, good.
I'm so excited to watch this.
Yeah. No, you got to. But you also have to tell me the inevitable question that I already mentioned to you. Do you feel successful, Yvonne?
Oh,
no, that was the other. We already dealt with that one. Do you feel successful?
I think so. I mean, I think what I feel successful in is that as I've grown up, I've kind of continuously developed my skill set and feel more comfortable and confident in my abilities. I think I and lots of people are always going to feel like they're faking it through.
Sure.
I felt like that when I had my store, but I think everybody feels like that.
Everybody does.
Everybody, except when I actually had lunch with my boss last week, we were talking about someone, I think someone's sister-in-law is a federal judge or something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there are a lot of middle-aged dudes. There are a lot of middle-aged dudes who believe that they aren't faking it and they do know everything, but it's just not the case.
Right. She was a woman, but anyways, my boss said, he's like, well, that's a grown-up job. I was like, it is.
Exactly.
You can't fake that. If you're a federal judge, can you imagine being I don't really know what I'm doing, but here's my decision. I feel I work in marketing.
Yeah, but you're senior marketer, blah, blah, blah. That's right. An adult job.
There's never it's not life or death. Do you know what I mean? There's never anything, even when emergencies come up at work and fire drills, it's just it's only marketing. Always used to say that at my old company. It's only marketing, guys. It's just,
Right, but you could say that about anything, though. I'm just
I guess, still. But not if you're a doctor, death row lawyer. I mean, I don't know. It's not, I think it's just, it's, it's important and it's money and these are big companies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, I work my ass off, but But yes, so
you
got to
put it in perspective,
like,
of course.
It.
I hear right. you, but it's still an yeah. adult job, like all the things you're
it
talking
a,
about.
I guess
there are a lot of but acronyms like, to learn, and there are a lot of...
so many acronyms. Oh, it's a joke. Like, it was like, is there an acronym for that? Like, every company, like, I'm like, I don't understand. We were trying to name some tool the other day.
Oh boy.
And my coworker was like, well, like, it could be this or it could be that. And everything was like, pricing tool today, like TPT, like that's not what it was, but you know, stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just have a question. I was like, don't take this the wrong way. I'm like, do we have to name it so it can be an acronym? I'm like, can we just call it like the pricing tool? Like, does it have to also equate to
revolutionary?
Or like, does it have to be like a fancy name? Because I can tell you that no one that uses it is going to refer to it by that fancy name. I think often marketers particularly like get way too into like the creative, and like, yes, marketing's a creative field, but like there's certain times where it's like, you can give a fancy name, but only you're going to be calling it that fancy name. Like, yeah. people that are using it just want it for what it is, right?
Sure.
And so I think that's always something to keep in mind. But yeah, do I feel successful? I do, I guess, and that, you know, I can support my family
yeah.
pretty much. And
that's good.
I like what I do, and I get, like I said, like have, you know, over the years learned how to make the things that I never even thought about when I was, you know, in my 20s, like writing as something that would be a career, figuring out how to use the things I like to do and the skills that I have to do work. But I think the most important thing, like, honestly, and I know it sounds dumb, but like, I don't think I would still be in tech if I didn't work with such awesome people when I first started at Aspera.
Yeah.
It's like who you work with that makes it cool and interesting and gives you opportunities to like learn and be creative and be curious and all that stuff. If you work with toxic people and nothing's going to be successful. So right. I think it's really all about the people. I think I could work in any industry, and as long as I work with cool people.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. Well, I think of you as successful for, you know, for those reasons. Like, obviously those are, you know, supporting the family and stuff. That's super important, you know, maybe more important than all the other stuff, but just the adaptability that you've sort of outlined through this whole thing, and the ability to know when it's time to pivot, but also it's also like a delegation thing. Like, you know, you just kind of seem, you always struck me as someone who just had it together. You have it together. And I'm, you know, thinking about me being an art school guy, hanging out with your sister who's an art school girl, and you're like, you were like the one who had it all together. Like, you just like had it figured out, and you seemed confident in the things that you're doing. And maybe you weren't 100% confident in it, but you seemed like it. And, you know, like, if you couldn't do something, you'd ask someone to do it for you or help you with it or show you how. You seem to like just get things done. And I think that that's a good quality and a good trait. And it seems to have served you well.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that was very nice. I think that I definitely didn't know what I was doing, but I was good at faking it. I am a big fan of asking questions.
Yeah.
And asking for help where you need it. And I think my own anxiety makes me get things done, because if I don't get things done, I'm so stressed. Like, I always describe myself as a slacker overachiever. Like, I'm super lazy.
That is awesome.
But like, I also like get so anxious if I'm procrastinating things yeah. too much, even though I like, you know,
you really you fear the deadline. Now,
you'd be like, right, exactly. Like, I'm not really good at like keeping things like super organized or clean, but like, yeah, like if like something hasn't been done, like if I haven't checked off everything on my mental list that I constantly forget because I'm old and I am too lazy to write it down, that stresses me out. And so getting things done is a way for me to, I don't know, combat my own anxiety, my own natural like medium to high level anxiety that surges through me all the time.
Yeah.
And my partner finds it annoying. He's like, can't stand that I can't like sit still. And he's like, you always have to do something. Like, whereas like, I'm like, I think a lot of people actually think that's a good skill that I have. But,
yeah. Like, but yeah. I mean, it's also nice to hang, just chill out for a while, but you know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always, but I think that's also just like a mom thing. Like almost every mom I know is like that, right? Like, it's right. like you want to just like hang out on the weekends and like read your book, but you feel guilty and you're like, there's like 17 other things I should be doing right now. But it is important. And I think like over the last couple of years, I actually have gotten much better at just recognizing that it's okay to do nothing.
It is okay.
Like, if I just want to sit down and read a book, and it's important to model that taking time for yourself behavior for your kids too. I think the hard thing for me is like, in one way, it's because I work at 100% from home now, that it's a great gift to be able to, you know, A, not waste like 2+ hours a day commuting back and forth anywhere and be racing around and all that other stuff. But, you know, to be around my kids more and to be more flexible. If somebody's, you know, sick, it's no big deal. They can stay home. There's like childcare, right. All the things.
That's convenient.
But it's so convenient. But on the other hand, I'm like always working. I'm always checking an email or writing a message. And because my team is all over the place, like I have a colleague in Singapore and was on the phone with her until 10 o'clock the other night.
Right.
In the morning for her.
Yeah.
Or 11 in the morning.
That's the downside.
Exactly. Or like my colleagues on the West Coast, like when it's 6 o'clock for me,
right.
It's only 3 o'clock for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that like the boundaries between work and family get real messy.
Sure.
And it takes some effort to, which I'm not great at always.
Yeah. Also, I can imagine that it like the boundaries blur and then you have no idea how much you're actually working and not working. your life is just this mess of making calls and making sandwiches.
I feel like the difference is like, I always struggle with being present with my kids. And I feel like it makes me, it's even harder, right? Because I'm like, hold on, like you want dinner, but I'm like trying to finish something.
Yeah.
Hold on, one more minute. Again, way better than wasting half my life commuting back and forth.
Oh, God. Yeah, commute is the worst, right? It's so nice not to commute. I mean, with my old job, I used to just walk 15 minutes and yeah, it was great. I feel like I'm supposed to ask you a bunch of other stuff.
Oh, really?
I kind of have the gist of everything.
Okay.
Is there something that you need to communicate?
I love my cat.
Yeah.
Cat's sitting next to me this whole time.
What is the cat's name?
Pistachio Rose.
Pistachio Rose.
So we're going away for a few days.
Nice.
It's almost February vacation here. And we're all such crazy cat people that actually last night, Derek and I might have ordered on Amazon like a nanny cam, but for cats. So it's a camera, but also a two-way audio so we can talk to her through it.
Aww.
And it has an app. You fill it up with treats and you press a button allegedly on your phone from Florida and it'll shoot a treat to her
really? Out
of the thing, which we think is completely going to blow her mind.
Probably.
It's coming tomorrow. It's a cat cam treat giving.
Well, you do work in the tech industry, so it makes sense.
I mean, he was the one that came up with this. Yeah, I don't even know. Because we can see her, but we're like, but she needs to see us. Like how can we figure this out? Should we get her a phone?
What?
Like, I was like, the treats will be good enough. I know. I was like, what? I'm like, could we hook it up to the TV so she could like see our faces? Like,
yeah.
How does this work? Yeah, we're that crazy. Can I ask you, what have you been doing for work and what kind of jobs are you looking for?
I used to work for a company that makes website software, making support material for them, doing all their support work and most of their communication. And it's still around, but everyone got laid off and now it's just that one guy. Yeah, I lost my job and I thought, I can do all these things, but I'm sort of like this jack of all trades. I do this, that, and the other thing. And I thought that I would have no trouble getting a job, but I was wrong. To be fair, I've been very picky, but it's kind of disappointing. I feel like most people look at my LinkedIn and they're just like, I'm good. I don't know.
But you just need to find somebody. Like, that's the thing. Like that was the really weird thing when I started like talking to my boss, Rich, is that like they were kind of like, no, this is why we want to talk to you.
Yeah.
We like that you're like a weirdo. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that's, I just kind of figured like some startup or something would be like, oh, this is precisely what we need.
I feel like you can figure it out. It's going to happen.
Yeah. One of these days it's going to all fall into place. It's just taking far longer than I expected. And it makes me sad.
I feel like that too.
But you know, whatever. On that note.
All right. Boom. Go make some eggplant.
I'm going to go make some eggplant.
I'm gonna get back to work. All right. Thanks, Jim. Good to talk to you.
Talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
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 That was Yvonne. It was really cool catching up with her. And I could have talked with her for hours about a number of things. There's so many things I liked about this episode, but for the sake of a tidy conclusion, I will say that the big takeaway is that you need to figure out how to use the skills that you have and the things that you like to do in any field. And you need to be able to illustrate that to a complete stranger in a compelling way. It's not so easily done. I always thought I was kind of doing that. But hearing her talk about it gives me hope that someday soon, I might find an employer who will welcome me with open arms. Also, her tips about interviewing and resume structure are great. Getting feedback on your interview and resume techniques from interviewers who declined hiring you is a solid idea, and turning your resume into an engaging story could be a viable option to make you more interesting to potential HR people or other types of people who are in charge of hiring. That said, I've heard from other office managers and HR folks that they only want streamlined simplicity and bullet points. I guess it all depends on the culture of the company. I think Yvonne should start a side hustle making digital online courses. From what I've heard, it's a great way to make money online these days. Thanks for being on the show, Yvonne. It was great talking to you, and we should do it again sometime. Maybe in Boston, or perhaps Amsterdam if you ever come back this way. And thank you, dear listener. I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. As usual, I'd like to remind you how much I appreciate your time. Feel Free to Deviate is provided free of charge to the world, and I would like to make the humble request that you recommend it to a friend and download and listen to all the episodes, in your own time, of course. If you feel like going to Apple Podcasts to leave a glowing 5-star review, that would be great as well. I'd really appreciate it. And in case you were wondering, I'm at Feel Free to Deviate on Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook, if that tickles your fancy. And you can find a website at feelfreetodeviate.com. If you feel the urge to contribute financially, there's a donate page on the website, but you can also go to buymeacoffee.com/feelfree. That's just feel free, no deviations. It's a quick, easy, and painless way to help offset the cost of running the show while simultaneously keeping me caffeinated, which costs more than you might think. The next episode, coming up in 2 weeks, will feature either pop maestro Tom Sturm or architecture power couple Valentina and Julio. Until then, try to enjoy as much as you can and be excellent to each other. Goodbye.